I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, in this special recorded program, we are going to be talking with Alida Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. Because this is a recorded No Limits, we are not going to be able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or via social media, but we do hope you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits with Alida Hodge. She is the author of a book about one of Indiana's cultural treasures and landmarks, Indiana Avenue. The title of the book is Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. This is a recorded program, so that means we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but I do hope that you will enjoy the conversation. Alida, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. So why don't you, I'm always interested with books, about the genesis of them. What inspired you to write it? Obviously, a mountain of research went into this one. So could you talk a little bit about how this book came to be?
Well, I would drive along Indiana Avenue and see that all the buildings and clubs and everything that was formerly there was gone, mm-hmm. except for the Madam Walker building and one club that used to be there. It was called A Place to Play, and it's now an Asian-themed bar at the corner of Indiana and Vermont Street. And I'd say, well, what happened? Where did everything go? And so I remember my parents and my uncles and aunts talking about how great the avenue was and what a great time they had. And I wanted to share this story with both young and older people. And so I interviewed about 35 musicians or their family members, if the musician was deceased, and asked them what was Indiana Avenue like. And so I didn't live too far from Indiana Avenue. I lived across the street from Attucks. And so I was always going to and fro Indiana Avenue. And so I just wanted to share my family story, an African-American family living in the Flanner House homes, and my grandparents' story. So,
And, you know, when you came in, because obviously this is not, you did not experience Indiana Avenue in its thriving heyday.
Right.
And all of that. So it's kind of a received cultural heritage for you. What was it initially about the Indiana Avenue story that fascinated you and drew you in? Because you got to commit an awful lot of time do something like this.
Well, just finding out that there was such a wealth of music that came through there from 1915 on to 2015 and all the different types of music. I was just curious, and I was just obsessed to tell the story. And I think that obsession led me to continue to do the research and just found so many hidden figures, mm-hmm. and finding out about Noble Sissel. He's one mm-hmm. of the first people in the book. And I'd heard of him, but I didn't know that he was a Butler University graduate and that he wrote the Butler fight song and then went on to produce the first black Broadway or off-Broadway show, Shuffle Along, that did not include minstrel characters. And he went and produced many other programs, in Europe and in the United States. And so, you know, he was fascinating. Yeah.
Where did your research start? I mean, which figure, you know, something like this, it strikes me, it is a huge, huge ball. You just have to start pulling at one thread and see where it leads.
Well, I guess I started with some of the writings that my family had written, like my father had written, like about a 10-page handwritten story of his experience in mostly World War II as an African-American soldier and what it was like. And then he described his mother. And so I wanted to find out more about her because I think she passed away when I was probably like in the sixth or seventh grade. And so I knew that she was a midwife, but I didn't know what that really entailed. And then watching the PBS show, the Call of the Midwife, that drew me in to show how women, ordinary women, did extraordinary things. And so she and Dr. Hummons delivered almost all the babies in Hallville. And it wasn't because they were living in a rural area where most midwives are. It was because of racial segregation that black women could not have their babies delivered in the hospital, which was on Indiana Avenue, right at 10th or Fall Creek and Indiana Avenue. So they had to have the doctor and the midwife come to their house.
So in terms of starting this, it started as, you started from your family then outward. What places did you go to after you looked at family documents to begin telling the story? Because it's a complex one.
Yes.
There are a lot of characters who move in and out of here.
Yeah, well, the other thing that influenced it was one of the first interviews I did was with one of the musicians, and his name is James Campbell, and he's about 88, and he has this phenomenal memory of Indiana Avenue. He worked at the Sunset Terrace and worked other places along the avenue, but he was mentored from the time he was like maybe 5 years old from Jerry Daniels, one of the original members of the Ink Spots. And so he told me all these fascinating stories, and it was just, we were just meeting him for lunch. Me and my friend Bob Hill introduced me to him. And so it was just curious. He talked about all of these musicians and the musicians who were nationally renowned who came through here, and where they stayed and what they did while they were here and moving along the Chitlin Circuit and what their life was. And his story was really fascinating. And so then that just really just made me want to go out and interview more people. And, you know, once you connect with one person, then they would say, oh, you need to talk with Al Coleman, or you need to talk with this or that person or their family relatives. And so it was really fun talking with all these people and sharing their stories.
Who was the hardest interview to get for all of this, would you say?
The hardest? Oh, well, there's some people that I tried and tried and never got an interview.
Oh, who did you really want to get that you couldn't get to?
Well, I was trying to get to someone like Babyface.
Yeah.
And didn't have very much luck, so, yeah. But most of the people were pretty receptive, so, yeah.
And, you know, how did you structure the interviews? What kind of questions did you ask them?
Just basic questions of their connection with Indiana Avenue, or the bands that they played with, or the type of work they were doing. And then for many of the family members, that's another difference with my book, is that many of the other books didn't talk with the family members. And so I talked with Kevin Johnson, the son of Pookie Johnson, and I talked with the Webster family, Russell Webster's wife, Lexi, and his daughter, Bonnie. And so, you know, just what their life was like, you know, trying to find out what was the story behind these musicians. And, I mean, these guys were led pretty crazy lives. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them ever slept. I mean, that's what people kept saying. Well, I don't know how, you know, my dad rarely slept. He slept maybe 4 hours or something like that. And I'm like, what? And, you know, just the time and effort that they put into it was just phenomenal. Yeah.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Alida Hodge in a recorded conversation. She is the author of Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. We're really talking about a cultural landmark and an important piece of our history and our heritage here in Indianapolis on No Limits. Because this is a recorded program, we cannot take calls or emails or answer or deal with questions or comments via social media, but I do hope you're enjoying the conversation. So which parts of the story did you find the most fascinating to research?
Well, I think some of the stories about women and how empowered women were, you know, back starting in 1915, one of the first characters that I found out about was Lillian LeMond, and she was a piano teacher and also voice. And so she trained the professionals of the day on how to play the piano, how to sing, how to, you know, performance skills. And these people not only came from Indianapolis, they came from all over, Chicago, St. Louis, Dayton, Louisville, and she had the Cosmopolitan School of Music in her house in the Ransom Historic Neighborhood, and she had two baby grand pianos, and she had several teachers on her staff, and then I Googled her name. I wanted to see if I could find a picture of her, and lo and behold, I found a picture of her. from like 1915, 1913. So that was pretty amazing. And so just to find women who were entrepreneurs and, you know, nurturing and training people. And, you know, first when I would tell people that I found this music teacher, people would assume that she was training children to play the pianos, but it was professional adults.
So she was working with the pros as well. Did she work with children as well, or was it exclusively professionals?
No, she did work with children too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and is some of that slice, because you know what we think of with Indiana Avenue is now it is pretty much Madam C.J. Walker all the time, which she was a towering figure.
Right. And
all of that, but does she swallow up a lot of these other stories because she is so prominent?
No, I don't think so. And that's what I wanted to show in the book, that there were women who were empowered and training other musicians. And
I guess the spirit of my question was, do we not know already about these women because she cast such a long shadow? You had to dig to find some of these other names and these other stories.
No, not really.
Okay.
Yeah. There were people that my family knew, like Jean Spears. She was the founder of the Ransom Place Historic Neighborhood. And so, but I think her story has not been told and shared with others. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't have the Ransom Place Historic Neighborhood of today.
Which I think actually we're talking past here a little bit, because that's what I was asking. Why haven't these stories been told before?
Yes.
Was it because that, you know, that they're just, well, I don't know. Why do you think they hadn't been told before?
Well, I don't know. I mean, she won awards for her work. But I think a lot of people were, you know, very low-key, industrious people. And they didn't really want the limelight for themselves. And they just wanted to achieve their goals, whatever they were. There were many people who trained other musicians but never claimed anything for themselves.
We are talking with Alida Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015, today on No Limits. This is a recorded program. That means that we are not able to take phone calls. We're not able to answer questions via email or deal with questions or comments that come in by social media. But we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what Indiana Avenue was like during the day, because the book creates a great picture of that. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this pre-recorded No Limits with Alida Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. Because this is a recorded program, we're not taking calls today, we're not taking emails or messages via social media, but we do hope you're enjoying this conversation about this lively slice of Indianapolis history and, you know, a part of our city that is a cultural landmark, often unsung, sadly. So, Alida, I asked, I teased when we were going to the last break and suggested we were gonna talk about what Indiana Avenue was in its day. Could, for those people, and I don't want you to ruin the experience of reading the book for them, so don't. We want them to go away and read the book, but could you paint a little bit of a word picture for, say, the transplants to our city or young people who may not be aware of what Indiana Avenue was?
Okay. Yes, Indiana Avenue is a diagonal street that radiates from now probably about Capitol going northwest to about 10th Street or Fall Creek, about a 10-block area. And back in the early days, it went all the way to Ohio Street, mm-hmm. where the One America building is. And it was filled with all kinds of shops, men's and women's clothing, milliner's shops, haberdashers, tailors, shoe shops, grocery stores, drug stores, candy, ice cream shops, all these clubs and restaurants. And people flocked to it from all over. And people knew the name Indiana Avenue. People dreamed of going there. Even John Dillinger had it on its bucket list when he was in prison up in Michigan City.
To get to Indiana Avenue.
Since he was from Mooresville originally. I don't know if he ever made it there or not, but it was always filled with people bustling here and there. There were buses going all over town. And on Saturdays, the weekends, it was filled with people. And there were four movie theaters, including one that was in the Walker Building. And they were showing the movies of the day, Gone with the Wind and others, and cartoons. And I remember going to the Walker Building as a young girl to have my hair done in the Madam Walker Training Center on Saturdays. And I would go there and basically kind of spend half the day there and go to see cartoons and movies and eat popcorn. And so at night, it mm-hmm. was the entertainment center. And so families would go home and then adults would come out and play. And people would drive long distances in their finest garb. And I've heard people say, yeah, we drove from Louisville or Elkhart or Gary and you know, we just had to get there and we had to see the entertainment. We had to see the blues joint or the jazz joint, or we had to go see Duke Ellington or Sarah Vaughan, and we weren't going to miss it. And, you know, you never looked tacky on the Avenue. You wore your best. And so people would, there were businesses inside the Madam Walker building, doctors, lawyers, dentists. There was a cab company in there. And I saw a picture of them displaying their cabs, and it was like maybe about 40 cabs lined up on Indiana Avenue where the theater marquee is. And so they operated out of that building. And then also the Madam Walker company was located there, and that's where they actually produced the hair care products that were shipped throughout the United States and also to the Caribbean. And by the early 1920s, she had about 950 hair representatives that were trained, and her business was set up on a modern scale where first people had to be trained how to use the product. They were trained on how to treat people's hair, and her whole hair product line was geared to helping women whose hair was damaged or had never been really treated well. Many of these women were working hard and in menial jobs, and that's how she lost her hair. She was a washerwoman before she started this business, and she wanted some kind of product because her hair was falling out from working under high heat conditions and cleaning people's clothes using a washer tub.
Oh, wow.
And here she went to become the first self-made female millionaire in the United States. And she owned several cars, and then she had a house on in New York near the Hudson River where the Rockefellers and the Tiffanys lived. And so
What was Indiana Avenue's heyday, would you say, when it was the most hopping?
I would say probably the late 20s through the 50s.
Okay. So it was like a 30-year run then.
Right, right. And so also during World War II, you had a lot of military people who had moved here for all the facilities that were here, like Fort Benjamin Harrison and the Naval Center, Hessler Center, and Camp Atterbury. And you had people come from all over the country, and they were exposed to jazz and music. And so they wanted to come here, and that's what they did. Yeah. So they flocked to the Avenue also.
And, you know, in that, at least in the popular mind, you're right. It's this huge sort of cultural mix here, a mosaic, you know, a stew, whatever you want to call it,
yes.
But something that... but probably in the popular imagination, and really the focus of your book, is it was this huge kind of magnet for musical talent, too.
Yes.
Talk about some of the people who played along the Avenue. And, you know, how you track their stories down.
Well, there's so many.
There are.
And so many stories. I would say, well, the Hampton family, they played on the Avenue, and they had moved here from Pennsylvania. And they lived over near, I think, where the IU School of Law is currently. And so they had about nine kids. And so they trained their kids, the parents trained the kids to play these different instruments. And then they also brought other people in and trained them. They also trained like David Baker and Larry Ridley and Wes Montgomery. And So they were just this nurturing, loving, you know, music machine. And so they played along the avenue, and then they also played in Cincinnati, and then they went on tour around the country. And the youngest one of the family is Slide Hampton, mm-hmm. and he's about 88. And he lives in New Jersey, and he's still performing, and he's still composing. And so I interviewed Dawn Hampton, and she was originally, she played the saxophone. And so later, when she went to New York to make her mark, she faced a lot of discrimination, both as a woman and as a black. And, you know, it's like no woman is going to play in a male band, in a male orchestra. And the club owners also wouldn't allow it. So she started singing cabaret music. Mm-hmm. And so she was...
So that was interesting that they wouldn't let her play the saxophone, but she could get up and sing if she wanted to.
Well, she was embraced by the gay community.
Okay.
And so she was singing cabaret music in their clubs, and they just loved her. And then later she lost her voice after a surgery, and so she started dancing.
Oh, wow.
And she was doing the Lindy Hop for like 20, 30 years. And she's included in the movie Malcolm X. They show a film, a section of the film.
The Spike Lee film?
And with her dancing with the famous Lindy Hop dancer. And so she was teaching New York University students at night at clubs in New York. And she passed away about 3 years ago. And I think she was out or getting ready to go out to a club, to a lesson. And so she never married and never had any kids on her own, but there's hundreds of people in New York who call her their mom. Mm-hmm.
Was that part of your motivation to do the book, is that a lot of these people who made this history, who
right.
lived these lives, aren't going to be with us that much longer?
Right,
and the
right.
stories, you know, if we're not careful, the stories will die with
right.
them.
Right, and that's what spurred me on, because I think she passed away, and then also David Baker passed away within months of each other. And so it's like, I got to get this book out. I got to, you know, hurry up and grab these people. And, you know, also most of the people who were still alive had good memories. Thank God. That's a blessing. And so I met Al Coleman, mm-hmm. and he owned the British Lounge Club. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of the last clubs on the avenue before it closed down. And he was a drummer himself, and he had played in the military during World War II. And so I was just fascinated when he told me that he used to play on the Chitlin circuit, and that was the circuit of
probably
towns.
I've been where a must. Yeah, we want to talk about what the Chitlin circuit is.
Yeah, it was a circuit of music where performers, it wasn't just music, musicians, actors, comedians that would perform at black locations because it was racially segregated. And they would drive by bus or by car or by train from as far west as Kansas City and as far south as Memphis, north as Chicago, and as far east as Harlem. And so Indianapolis was like the crossroads of this circuit. And so Al told me that he played at a different venue every night, stayed in a different hotel every night, and then they would travel on during the day and then do the same thing over again. It's like, that's not a crazy lifestyle. You don't know where you're going to eat or sleep the next night, mm-hmm. or, you know, perform. Yeah. So it was a wonderful circuit of talent, and people were welcomed in each town. Many of them could not stay in the white hotels, so there were many boarding houses, or they stayed with individuals' homes. And so,
like this improvised network by which they could travel.
Right.
So if you're just joining us, by the way, we are talking with Alida Hodge, who is the author of Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. So we probably ought to talk, too, about what it was that made Indiana Avenue and Indianapolis this kind of magnet. I mean, why so much talent appeared here? What drew people to Indiana Avenue?
Well, I think there was all this talent. There were large churches here, like Bethel AME Church, and they had excellent music directors. I can't remember her name. Miss Howard. She was the director of music, and there were other large churches, but that was the first or the largest African-American church in Indianapolis. And so I think it was the nurturing environment, and then also Crispus Attucks was just a powerhouse of music, and they had the best instructors. Crispus Attucks was built in 1927, and it was built to relieve, quote, the overflow of students from other high schools, but it was built to segregate blacks to one high school instead of blacks at being allowed to go to Shortridge or Manual. And so they thought that that would eliminate the racial conflicts, but instead it created magnificent people coming out of one high school with teachers that had PhDs or master's degrees, but they couldn't get jobs at colleges, so they came to Attucks.
Oh, yeah, the Attuck stories is like no other.
Right,
But, you know, part of what I'm also curious about is, you know, in the 2 minutes or so we've got before we hit a break, is what it was, because a lot of this is not just people who grew up here. Talent came from all over the country to play on the Avenue.
Right.
What drew them here?
Well, just going to all these routes. You know, they had to go to Kansas City. They had to go to Chicago, and this was the natural stopping point along the road. Yeah.
So that's what created this, you know, the Avenue. And what was it about the 1920s, do you think, that caused it to spring up, make it come to life in the way it did? Because that was its heyday.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. But just in the 20s, there was so much wonderful music. Yeah, so I don't know what really.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, because it could have been transportation, too. The fact that automobiles and all of that made the sort of transportation challenges easier for all musicians, regardless of their racial heritage.
And then the trains were here, so that was a natural stopping point, too. Yeah, the Union Station wasn't far away. Yeah. And, you know, you had places like Kansas City and Chicago where people just had to go.
To get to.
Yeah.
And that those were you know, similar kind of cultural capitals. Well, part of what I want to talk about when we come back from the break is why Indiana Avenue is not more renowned than it is. You know, there obviously, we celebrate the Chicago's rich jazz heritage, New Orleans, St. Louis, and, of course, Beale Street in Memphis is this huge cultural icon. Why not Indiana Avenue? We are talking in this recorded No Limits with Alida Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. Because this is a recorded program, we're not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media, but I do hope you're enjoying the conversation. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media, but I hope you're enjoying the conversation. We're talking with Alida Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015. Before we went to the break, I sort of teased the question that we're going to talk about why Indiana Avenue is not better known beyond Indianapolis and Indiana than it is. I talked about how, you know, people associate jazz in particular and the blues with Chicago, with St. Louis, with New Orleans, and of course Beale Street, which in some ways was a sibling to Indiana Avenue, is world famous in Memphis. Why does Indiana Avenue not have that kind of renown? And then I'll pose, is your book an attempt to sort of redress that injustice?
Well, that's, you know, also one of the reasons I wrote the book, just so that we do honor the legacy of the music. And so there's many reasons that people have come up with, but none of them really satisfies the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Beale Street and 18th and Vine, mm-hmm, in Kansas City, I mean, they're very short areas. They're not, mm-hmm, probably not as large as what Indiana Avenue was.
Yeah, Indiana Avenue stretched for quite a while,
yeah,
during its heyday,
yeah,
too.
And so some of the people who became famous, like J.J. Johnson, he was from here, and, you know, he was one of the best trombonists.
Mm-hmm.
And people knew him in New York. He played in New York for a long time. But a lot of people did know that he was from Indianapolis. The Ink Spots, mm-hmm, were originally from Indianapolis, and their span was like from the early 1930s to the 60s, because as members passed,
yeah,
away or left the band, then other people would replace them. And many people didn't know that they were from Indianapolis, and they set all kinds of records. They have the record for the first single song on a 45. And it sold like 7 million copies, like in the 30s or 40s. And no one has beat that record since then. And so I really can't give an explanation for why it wasn't.
It's not better known than it is.
Right.
So
right.
Let me ask that, because we've pointed out you came into this world, came into this life in some ways after that period,
right,
when Indiana Avenue, stopped being one of the centers of the musical universe and became a street, and an important street, mm-hmm, in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. But it was transformed. What, when you were writing the book, were there certain parts of that history when you were doing the research or when you were doing the writing when you really thought, oh, wow, I have disappeared into this era now. I've written a book, you know, and I've done the research things, and there are moments when you almost, not entirely, because you don't get to bend time at your will,
yeah,
or anything like,
yeah,
that, but you really think, oh, yeah, I can see how it was.
Yes, yes.
What were those moments where it really came alive for you, would you say?
Well, it would come alive when I was talking with the musicians and interviewing them, and they were talking about the fun times that they had on the Avenue and how they would play at different performances around town at private parties or clubs or hotels. And then on Saturday nights, they would continue on to an after-hours joint, which is where musicians would go after they performed and just hang out. And they would have their own little competitions to see who was the best drummer or the best trumpeter or who could play this song the best. So they were very competitive. And so at one place called Henry's, that's where they would have these Saturday night competitions that could last till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the mornings. So you'd wish that you could step back in time and be in Henry's on a Saturday night and witness this, or be in the casino ballroom at the Madam Walker and see the women and the men in these fabulous outfits, gowns and tuxedos and beaded dresses. And I still wish that was true.
In terms of that part of the life, what surprised you the most in the writing and the research here? Because that's the other thing that at least I love when I'm reporting or researching something, is I always find something that I didn't know that ends up just fascinating me.
Well, I think, to know that in this wonderful space of 10 blocks that, there was racial segregation and that the Klan was the largest number of Klan members outside of the South, and yet that didn't stop people. And, they weren't afraid to come here from out of state sometimes and perform. And
that's true. I hadn't even thought of the connection, because at the time Indiana Avenue was really taking off is also the time when Indiana became the only state in the country where the Klan got control of the state government.
Yes, and the leader of the Klan lived here in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. The Grand Dragon, that was his title.
D.C. Stevenson.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so my parents would talk about the Klan. And so in spite of the racism, mm-hmm. Indiana Avenue thrived and excelled at the best and being the best. And I read a write-up by David Brent Johnson of WFIU radio down in Bloomington. And he said something about there must have been something in the water that these mm-hmm. people were drinking, because there was so much talent that came out of here. J.J. Johnson, Freddie Hubbard, Larry Ridley,
Wes Montgomery,
the Montgomery brothers, the Hampton family. And so maybe it was the water that they were drinking, but I mean, they were like bred to be the best. And several of the Hamptons said that their father taught them that, once you walk on the stage, you are a performer. You leave everything behind mm-hmm. you. And you just perform to the maximum of your ability and no excuses. And so I think that it's, like you say, a landmark of talent and of achievement despite all the odds.
What part of the story did you find the hardest to research? We talked about the people that you wanted to interview that you couldn't necessarily
yeah.
get to. But anyone who's done research like this realizes there are times or questions you want to get answered and you just run into a wall. Either time has swallowed up the document or the information or the people you needed to talk to and the stories went with them, or some other factor.
Well, there were other people that I wanted to interview and there were time constraints or, health issues. Mm-hmm. And so then you just had to move on. And then there were other people who would say, well, if you can't get an interview with this person, then here's someone else. And so I found another jewel person named Carl Perkins. And
not the guy who wrote Blue Suede Shoes, a different Carl Perkins, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he played the piano, and he was an Addicts graduate. And he had an unusual way of playing the piano. He played the bass keys with his left elbow.
Oh, wow.
And he was playing, regular piano with his right hand. And he played. He graduated from Addix, and he went. He was in the Korean War, and then he was out in California, and he played with all the bands in California. The California, I guess the name of it, the Cool Breeze.
Mm-hmm.
It was the opposite of the hard bop sound of New York City, and so you know. Hearing his story was unusual. So it was unusual stories that were interesting. But I think the hardest part was not the research, because I love to research, but telling my own story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, it was okay to write about my grandparents.
Yeah.
But when it came time to me, it's like, no, I don't think I want to talk about that.
And that's hard to kind of reveal.
Yeah.
And all of that. So... let me ask this. You know, Indiana Avenue was this huge, thriving cultural force, and it's still an important street, but it's not what it was. What changed it? You know, what forces produced sort of the end of all of the clubs and all of that, the things that drove thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to come there year after year?
Well... there are many things. There was urban renewal, which some people refer to as urban removal. that was a very popular way to get rid of old dilapidated buildings, which many of them were. And then there was the highway, 65 and 70, that went right near it. People thought it was going to go even encroach even further on it. And then there was IUPUI. And then there was building new apartment complexes like the Lockfield Gardens, which was developed for low-income African-Americans. And so that was a good thing, because many of the houses that were there were in very bad, poor health conditions, poor drainage, mosquitoes, infestations, and there was the spread of TB, and so, you know, they needed to clean it up for public health reasons. And so people went from having an outhouse and carrying in water to having, you know, a drain, modern appliances, restroom facilities, heating. It was well ventilated, well designed, and people were proud to live there. And so that was a major shift. And so it was a multiple number of reasons, but people still ask today, well, why did they get rid of all of the clubs?
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't some allowed to remain?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the last one that standing was Al's British Lounge, and people said that it was very reputable, wonderful place to go. And as one gentleman described to me, if you wanted to impress a lady, that's the place.
That's
where
you went. Yeah, that's where you took her. So, so can we talk a little bit about what we lost when we lost the Avenue?
Well, we lost a lot. It wasn't just the music, because it was all these commercial businesses and a culture. And so I think now we need to focus on what we can do to preserve that memory and put up memorials and see if we can get any kinds of entertainment clubs to come back and have those still in existence and have memorials that tell the story. We do have a few sculptures or pictures up. There's one on IUPUI's campus. I think it's on Blackford Street. And it recognizes Madam Walker and Wes Montgomery and many other examples. And then there's a pocket park on St. Clair Street that recognizes Madam Walker and her attorney, Mr. Ransom, who lived in Ransom Place. But we need more to recognize and tell the story because we have millions of people who come to Indianapolis for all kinds of venues. We have mm-hmm. students who attend IUPUI who have no idea about this.
About what, yeah, what yeah. the world, the steps they're walking.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
walking along. So, I mean, would plaques do the story, or what other steps, besides obviously everyone should read your book, right?
yes, they should definitely read the book, that's for sure. We'll also support our artist groups, such as the Asante Children's Theater, which is housed in the Madam Walker Building, and it teaches young people not only acting and performing mm-hmm. dance skills, but also academic skills and how to, you know, manage their time, how to set priorities. And they're doing a wonderful job. They've been in existence, I think, around 28 years. So they must be doing something right.
We're getting close on time here. We've got just a couple of minutes left. So I want to ask, is this it, or do you have other books planned? And if so, what are they?
No, I don't have any other books planned.
Did this one kill your desire?
No. I would like to do other projects related to this. And
such
make
as?
Make the music come alive.
So yeah. What other yeah. projects would you like to do?
Well, I'd like to do a CD of the music.
Oh, okay.
And so as you read the book, you yeah. would have music that...
That reflects what you're talking about
right.
in the book. Are there other stories from Indiana Avenue that you would like to tell, or do you think you've told it all?
Oh, here? No. And then as I tell the story, people tell me, oh, did you know about my aunt, or did you know about my uncle? And so I'm still taking notes on stories that people have to say. And so,
how long did it take you to write this one?
It took 3 years. Yeah.
And the bulk of that, was the bulk of that the research, or how long did the actual writing take? Or were you doing them simultaneously?
Simultaneously.
Okay.
Or as I finished one chapter, then I'd have to do research on the next chapter's topics and meet more people. And so the last chapter, I interviewed the people in the last 3 or 4 months before it was published, yeah.
So, and it's just been out for a few months.
Yes.
So
yes.
It is a new book. Well, I'd like to thank you. I found it fascinating to read, and I think other people will as well. It is a really intriguing part of our history that is not explored nearly enough.
Thank you.
So I'd like to thank my guest, Alita Hodge. She is the author of the book Indiana Avenue, Life and Musical Journey from 1915 to 2015, for being my guest today and for sharing these wonderful, wonderful stories with you. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I'd like to also remind our listeners that we will be back next Tuesday with a live program, and we look forward to talking with you then. I am John Krull. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.